Chapter 4. Mark minus 28.27.50.
I asked to join the advance,
says Sorot Churi. For the first time since their reunion, Luciel notes a discomfort in his friend's disposition. And for the first time, he also reflects that they are not friends at all. What would be a better word? Comrades, perhaps? They have met once before, 8 years previously. Happenstance drew their companies together in the defence of Hantavania Sebros, the last of the tower cities of Cascian. Side by side, for 4 Terran months, they fought off an insect species whose name or language they never learned. Comrades of circumstance. Circumstance makes decisions for us all. The simple truth, unglossed, is that the Legion Astartes, 13th Ultramarines, and the Legion Astartes, 17th Wordbearers, are not close. Despite their superficial similarities, they're worlds apart in terms of their organization and combat ideology. They are as unlike each other as the Primarchs who lead them. Any fool can see that the Emperor's original purpose in creating his legions and his sons was to generate a variety of fighting forces that would embellish and complement one another. Their various strengths and characters were supposed to shine in contrast. There is, in uniformity, weakness. And as brothers are different, so they clash. There are rivalries and arguments, fallings out and bickering, envy and competition. This, too, is supposed to be part of the healthy organic process of the Legionis Astartes. This is the Emperor's vision. Let his sons compete. Let his legions challenge one another. That way they will spur one another on. That way they will do better. The Emperor and his oldest, wisest sons are always there to stop things going too far. Honorius Luciel and Sorot Churi stand on the observation deck above the principal hold of the cruiser Samothrace. They have greeted each other with respect and affection and spent the day supervising the transfer distribution of army personnel and munitions from Churi's war carrier to the troopships in Luciel's oversight. They are alike in stature, alike in rank, one red, one blue, as though stamped from identical fabricatory presses, and then finished in different paints.
"We have a bond, I believe," says Churi. "I hope I am not wrong."
"We do," Luciel agrees. "It was an honour to serve with you on Cascian."
"We are therefore unusual," Churi ventures.
Luciel laughs.
"You asked to join the advance," says Luciel. "I imagine your Primarch was supportive."
"He was."
"Just as mine was," Luciel replies. "When I requested the duty of close protection of Numinous High Anchor, we are cast in the roles of ambassadors, brother."
"This is my feeling,"
Churi nods, greatly relieved that it is now, after hours in each other's company, at last being spoken of.
"We are, I believe, the only genuine point of friendship between our legions," says Luciel. "No wonder we find ourselves paving the way for the conjunction."
They walk along the deck under the immense arches of the hold rib vaults.
"My legion's pride is bruised," says Churi.
"Of course it is," Luciel replies. "Wounded, I would say. And this is the remedy. Our legions will serve alongside each other in collaborative effort and thus bond. Our experience serves as an example in miniature."
"There has been talk of this as an exercise," replies Churi, "that the War Master is flexing his authority by commanding two of his brothers, especially one who is so mighty in his own right. But that is smoke. I think War Master Horus is displaying remarkable insight. He knows that as things stand, the unity of any line formed by the Wordbearers and the Ultramarines will be flawed."
"War Master Horus, in his infinite wisdom, has clearly studied the report on the Cascian campaign."
"He has, I think."
Bad blood can take a long time to dilute. Sometimes it must be let out. The point of contention, the bruised pride, is simple. Dissatisfied with the progress and performance of the 17th during the Great Crusade, the Emperor sent the Ultramarines to chastise them. It was an absolute and humiliating rebuke, and stemmed from the Emperor's distaste for the Word-Bearer's zealotry, especially when it came to the veneration of his own person as divine.
The emperor's truth was the secular, imperial truth. He tolerated more pious attitudes amongst his sons, but only so far. It was perhaps the Ultramarines' misfortune to be used in such a way, not just any legion, but the largest, the most secular, the most efficient, the most disciplined, the most, it could be argued, successful. Luciel is sympathetic. He has spoken privately with his Primarch on the subject on several occasions, because Guilliman is evidently bothered by it too. To be used as an instrument of humiliation and as an example of perfection does not sit comfortably. Guilliman is concerned that things will never be right in his relations with the word-bearers. It is clear from the way he has repeatedly quizzed Luciel, the only officer of the 13th to have ever engineered a reasonable confidence with an officer of the 17th. For the word-bearers have only ever been loyal and devoted. Luciel knows this. He has no doubt about the level of Churé's absolute loyalty. They had their devotion questioned and vilified by the very object of that devotion. Horace Lupercal, War Master, is demonstrating his wisdom and perception right at the start of his command. He is healing wounds. He is actively working to set two of his largest legions at ease with each other and close the bitter rift.
"On Cascian," says Luciel, "I learned a lot from you, Sorot. I learned to wonder at the stars and to appreciate the humbling scale of our galaxy."
"And I learned from you," Churé replies. "I learned the close analysis and appraisal of my enemies, and thus remeasured my own capacity as a warrior." The exchange is candid. On Cascian, Churé reminded Luciel of his place in a greater universe. Though he did not try to convert the Ultramarine's captain to any form of spiritual belief, he was able to help him glimpse the ineffable, the cosmic mystery that reminds a man, even a powerful transhuman, of his tiny part in the great design which forms the beating, vital heart of any faith. In effect, Churé gave Luciel perspective that beneficially diminished Luciel's sense of self in the face of the universe. It showed Luciel his place and reminded him of his purpose. In return, Luciel demonstrated to Churé the rigours of practice and theory, a robust schooling that pierced the veil of spirituality with a welcome pragmatism. Luciel reminded Churé he was superhuman. Churé reminded Luciel he was only superhuman. Both benefited immeasurably from the exchange of perspectives.
"I would know great joy," says Luciel, "if our brothers on both sides could come to celebrate their common differences the way we have."
"I have no doubt," replies Churé, "that this conjunction will bring an end to the hostility between our legions." Mark minus 26.43.57. Eonid Thiel, marked for censure, awaits his interview. He has been aboard the McCrag's Honour for some hours. He was told to wait. He is expecting to be called into the presence of Sharad Antoli, master of the 13th chapter. He is braced for this. The rebuke will be unstinting, and discipline duties will follow. He has already been through it once from Tayrone, his company captain. During this interview, Thiel made the mistake of attempting to justify his actions. He will not repeat the error when he is called before Chapter Master Antoli. Thiel has been obliged to wait in a huge anteroom on the 40th deck. It is a display arsenal lined with weapons. There are burnished practice cages on raised platforms down the centre of the chamber. After 3 hours of standing perfectly still, he relents, removes his helm, and begins to wander the empty chamber, admiring the weapons on display. Most are blade weapons, many master-crafted. They represent the peak weapon craft of 1,000 cultures. This is an exemplar collection where the highest-ranking officers of the 13th come to study weapon types, rehearse and practice with them, and thus improve their theoretical and practical differentials. Thiel knows he is unlikely to ever come so close to such perfect specimens again. He fights the temptation to take some of the weapons down and examine them. He wants to feel the comparative weights, the individual balances. When no one has come for a great stretch of time, Thiel reaches a hand out towards a longsword suspended against the wall on a gravity hook. "Sergeant Thiel?" Thiel stops and quickly withdraws his hand. A deck officer in ceremonial dress has entered the chamber.
"Yes?"
I have been asked to inform you that you will not have to wait much longer.
I will wait as long as I am required to, replies Thiel.
Well, the officer shrugs, it will not be much longer. Logistical issues have taken priority. The Primarch will call you shortly. He turns to leave.
Wait! The Primarch?
Yes, Sergeant.
I was waiting to be called by Chapter Master Antoli, says Thiel.
No. The Primarch.
Ah, says Thiel.
The deck officer waits a moment longer, concludes that their conversation is done, and walks out.
The Primarch?
Thiel breathes out slowly. It is safe to estimate that he is in about as much trouble as it's possible to be in which case... He takes down the longsword. It has extraordinary balance. He sweeps it twice, then turns towards the nearest practice cage. He halts. He turns back.
Might as well be damned for the whole as a part.
He takes down a Rathian sabre, half the length of the longsword, almost the same weight. A blade in each hand, he walks to the cage.
Rehearsal. Single sparring mode. Dual wielding. Extremity level 8. Commit.
The cage hums into life. The armature system rises around him, clattering as it begins to turn. Thiel hunkers down. He raises the two priceless blades. Mark minus 25.15.19. Their lift is delayed. Something about a storm out over Karen province. The sky in the east goes mauve, like a blood bruise. Sergeant Hellock tells them to bed down and wait for the call. Their lift is delayed, but not in any way that will allow Trooper Bale Rain to leave the site and go and see his girl.
Standing orders apply, no exceptions, says the sergeant.
Then he softens slightly.
Sorry, Rain. I know what you were hoping.
Bale Rain sits down and leans his back against a loader pallet. He's beginning to think that he will spend the rest of his life looking at Sergeant Hellock's face and never see Neves again.
The truth could hardly be more contrary.
Is that singing?
Asks Crank. He gets up.
That's singing, he says.
Rain can hear it. 200 meters away, on the other side of some perimeter fencing, is a compound occupied by army forces that have arrived with the 17th. A ragged mob they look, just the sort of fringe-world vagabonds you'd expect to come scurrying along on the heels of the zealot word-bearers. They had received a great deal of critical commentary from Sergeant Hellock as they disembarked, criticism that included uniform code, formation, equipment maintenance, and parade discipline.
"Oh, that's just embarrassing,"
Hellock says, lighting a low stick as he watches them dismount from the troop landers.
They look like bastard vagrants, like shit-stupid hunters from some arse-end world.
The soldiers from off-world indeed do not look promising. They are ragged. There is a wildness to them, as though they have been deprived of something vital for too long. Their skin is pale and their frames are thin. They look like plants that have been starved of light in a cave. They look like heathens.
That's just what we need, says Hellock. Heathen auxiliary units.
They're singing. Chanting. It is not a comfortable or attractive sound. It's atonal. It's actually quite unpleasant to listen to.
That's going to have to stop, the sergeant says.
He grinds the butt of the low stick under his heel. He crosses the yard to have a word with the commander of the other unit. The chanting bothers him.